Today is Wednesday, April 17th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up...
The Vatican has said it is willing to help and to send in some of its experts, some of the restoration teams that work at the Vatican. But the official in charge of culture at the Vatican has said there will be no funding.
That's reporter Catherine Field in Paris. We'll have the latest on the cathedral fire coming up. Also ahead, supporters of WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange clash with riot police in Ecuador's capital. And polling groups say that Indonesia's President Joko Widodo is ahead in the country's presidential election. It's all on today's International Edition. Well, while pledges continue to pour in for the rebuilding of France's Notre Dame Cathedral, so far an estimated $900 million from private donors has come in. The Vatican will not be a contributor. During a news conference at the Vatican yesterday, Cardinal Gianfranco Ravasi, president of the Pontifical Council for Culture, said France is economically self-sufficient and that the entrance fee for Notre Dame was intended as a fund for eventual situations and restorations. Meanwhile, more details have emerged on how the Paris Fire Brigade set up a wall of water between the wooden roof and the stone facade in order to save the stone facade from the fire. I spoke with reporter Catherine Field in Paris about the latest developments on the aftermath of the cathedral fire.
The Vatican has said it is willing to help and to send in some of its experts, some of the restoration teams that work at the Vatican. But the official in charge of culture at the Vatican has said there will be no funding, said that the church in France is independent of the Vatican and is able to deal with this cost of the renovation, this enormous cost of the renovation of Notre Dame de Paris on its own.
How are people reacting to this?
There's a bit of a shock, really, because one of the big outpourings of not just grief, but also of money, of funds that came from French people as soon as it became known that the restoration work was going to be extensive, seemed so natural. If you have a look, already 800 million euros has been donated to the fund to help get Notre Dame de Paris back up and running. So for the Vatican to have said, no, there's no money at all, did come as a surprise.
Also, just looking at the actual building, I understand that the Paris Fire Brigade, they did a special setup to protect the stone facade from the fire. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, it was an incredible effort that they went to. It's a system that's called boundary cooling. And what they did was they had to save the facade of the Notre Dame de Paris, that facade which has got those two famous towers and the bells, that was at risk of being engulfed in the flames. So what they did was they set up this wall of water between the roof, the oak roof that was on fire, and to the stone facade. And they were pumping some 4,000 liters of water a minute between that facade and the roof to stop the fire from engulfing the towers. Now, essentially, the decision they made, and they said it was, you know, they were really hoping against hope, the decision was that let the roof burn out. It's oak, it's old, okay, but that can be replaced and it's not as dangerous, and save the tower. And of course, they were saying there was just that critical moment of between 15 minutes and 30 minutes when they thought that this actual system of putting in this cooling wasn't going to work. But they now say that that particular moment when they made that decision saved the towers.
And I'm sure many people are happy that they did that.
Oh, they are, absolutely. And this morning in Paris, you still have hundreds of people coming out to the banks of the River Seine across from Notre Dame de Paris and having a look, because one gets the feeling that even if you live in Paris, there was a lot of people who took Notre Dame de Paris for granted, and now suddenly discovering that for a very short time, for about an hour and a half on Monday evening, there was the risk that that famous double tower was going to collapse. And so you see people saying, we took her for granted. She might look a bit under the weather now because that roof is completely gone. And now that it is there, you find that people are standing there saying, gosh, we took this 850-year-old cathedral for granted for too long.
That was reporter Catherine Field. She spoke with me from Paris. Well, it's been less than a week since Sudan's military responded to mass pro-democracy protests by arresting President Omar al-Bashir and declaring a 2-year transition to civilian rule. Still, many protesters are unappeased and continue to demonstrate peacefully outside military headquarters in Khartoum. Well, how fluid is the situation in Sudan today, and how does it compare to 1985? Well, VOA's Adam Phillips posed these questions to Mohammed Suleiman. He is a Sudanese-American and leader of the Darfur San Francisco Bay Area Coalition, and he's co-founder of Act for Sudan, an alliance of nearly 80 pro-democracy groups in the U.S.
So far, Bashir is out. That's good news, but still it is not over. The military council may not hand over the power to the people. What they want to do, the military council and the remnants of the regime of al-Bashir, get to see those young people disperse.
And do you think all those demonstrators will obey those orders and disperse?
Well, they are determined. I mean, they are young and they want to see change to the end. They don't want to see any comeback of the old guard. The country is in complete ruins, economically and socially, and more than that, there is no freedom. So in order for the youth to see this through, they have to stay put. And that's the only pressure that can be exerted on the military council to hand over the power to the people.
In terms of this uprising, how does it differ, or does it differ, from the popular uprising in 1985, which I'm told many of the parents of these protesters participated in? And if it does differ, how might that be an indication for how things will ultimately play out?
Well, the uprising in 1985 was successful that Numeri, the dictator at that time, to be ousted. But unfortunately, the military intervened and the professional politicians took over. At this time, from what actually we see on the ground, these young people, they are determined not to repeat that mistake again. This time, change will be completely different and it will be full.
How organized are these protesters actually? Are they united in their demands and what they claim? Or are they mostly just a random collection of people who nevertheless agree that al-Bashir had to go and a civilian government has to be formed?
Well, so far, I mean, they outlined some goals that although they're broad, but they want to see civilian government, they want to see democracy, and they want to see freedom.
I understand that women were really in the vanguard in this uprising, more so than in the past.
Yes, women, they played a great role. They were very brave. They were on the front line and took all the beatings from the security forces. And now the Sudanese people, they admire the Sudanese women more and more and appreciate their role. So I expect women, they will play even greater role in coming Sudan.
Do you think a civilian government and a new constitution will mean the abolition of Sharia law?
Once we have democracy and the choice of the people, this will be a country open to all. The diversity in Sudan might be the source of richness of the country. And that's what the young people now are calling for. They call for an open Sudan for all citizens, regardless of religion, regardless of race, regardless of ethnicity, and regardless of the region where you come from. At the same time, also, they want to see all kinds of freedoms, freedom of expression and freedom of movement, and they don't want any of the old guard to be back.
Sudanese-American activist Mohammed Suleiman is chairman of the Darfur San Francisco Bay Area Coalition and the co-founder of Act for Sudan. He spoke with VOA's Adam Phillips. Well, supporters of WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange clashed with riot police in Ecuador's capital yesterday. Clashes broke out close to the presidential palace after the country revoked Assange's asylum at its London embassy last week. Several people were arrested and others wounded, including journalists and photographers. The 47-year-old Australian national had been living in Ecuador's embassy in London since 2012, but was ejected last Thursday and taken into custody by British police. Ecuador said Assange broke asylum conventions by continuing to interfere in other countries' affairs by publishing confidential information. Assange had taken refuge in the Ecuadorian embassy in order to avoid being extradited to Sweden to face sexual assault charges. Among the top stories in the world, Ukrainian authorities say they have arrested seven people they claim were sent by Russian security services to carry out political killings and other terrorist acts, including the slaying of Ukrainian intelligence agents. And a new report documents a modest decline in torture allegations in Afghan prisons, but noted its ongoing concern at the disturbingly high number of conflict-related detainees still alleging serious abuses. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is VOA's International Edition. Polling groups said today that Indonesian President Joko Widodo is ahead in the country's presidential election. The so-called quick counts based on data collected at polling stations showed Widodo about 10 percentage points ahead of challenger Prabowo Subianto. Indonesia's Election Commission is expected to release the official results next month. VOA's Ira Melman spoke with Tom Popinski, professor of government specializing in Southeast Asia at Cornell University, on some of the issues concerning Indonesians in this election.
As always, the main issue for Indonesian politicians and Indonesian voters is effective government. Indonesia is a country which is a lower middle income country with aspirations to leap into the ranks of upper middle income and then developed countries in the next half century. But it's a country that's also marked by great inequality, both across classes and across regions of this large country. And so one issue is always going to be the state of the economy, who's better able to provide for the needs of ordinary Indonesians, and who has a better plan for increasing, as the Indonesians would say, the prosperity of the Indonesian people. So this is one issue for sure. This is centered around, in particular, the question of infrastructure. Indonesia is a country of 10,000 islands, a large and diverse country, and so getting people and goods from place to place is actually not easy to do in Indonesia. Joko Widodo has campaigned on his successes in providing for infrastructural development. Jakarta has a new subway, which is set to open very soon. And so these are issues that are first and foremost in the minds of Indonesian voters. There is, though, the issue of religion and identity, which is always in the background in Indonesian politics. This is a proudly diverse country. It is not a Islamic state, although the population is about 88% Muslim. And so there is a question about what is the proper role for Indonesia, for Islam in Indonesian public life. And it, in broad terms, you can view this as a contest between a candidate who represents a more explicitly Islamist vision for Indonesia's future and a more explicitly multi-ethnic and multi-religious vision.
Now, Indonesia does have the world's largest Muslim population, is that correct?
That's right. There's about 230 million Muslims in Indonesia, which is more Muslims than in Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Iraq, and Iran, and Turkey combined.
Talk about infrastructure. Indonesia has accepted a lot of money, a lot of projects from China. Is this an election issue as well?
This is not an election issue in the way that you might imagine, because neither candidate has really focused on China as a strategic threat in the terms of infrastructure cooperation. It is fair to say that Indonesians are generally wary of becoming overly reliant on China. At the same time, China is the source of a lot of development financing. And so both sides are increasingly aware of the need to find the right way to manage that relationship.
There have been reports of possible fraud, especially the discovery of what are thought to be fraudulent ballots in a warehouse several weeks ago. What's the overall feeling about that?
Certainly, Indonesians are going to be very vigilant about the conduct of the elections coming up. I do think that there is marginally greater chance that we'll see an effort by certain politicians or certain camps to push the elections in one direction or another using fraudulent means. But I've seen no credible evidence that this is going to be a threat to the overall integrity of the elections writ large.
Do you see a real challenge to Widodo here or not?
If we were to believe the polls, he leads by a comfortable margin. Does not seem to be as large as the margin by which he won last time, which was about 6%. But I do think that he can be fairly confident that he's going to win in this election.
That was Tom Popinski, professor of government specializing in Southeast Asia at Cornell University, speaking with VOA's Ira Melman. Well, U.S. President Donald Trump has vetoed a congressional resolution to end U.S. military assistance in the Saudi-led war in Yemen. In explaining his veto, Trump calls the resolution an unnecessary, dangerous attempt to weaken his constitutional authorities. He also said it endangers the lives of American citizens and service members. The United Arab Emirates hailed the veto as strategic assertion of Trump's support to the Arab coalition in Yemen. Stephen Sechet, a former U.S. ambassador to Yemen, spoke to VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawy about the possible impact of the president's veto on the ongoing war in Yemen.
I'm not sure we'll see much of an impact in terms of the ongoing war in Yemen because of this action. I think people generally had imagined that President Trump would veto the legislation, much like his predecessors. And any president, he would much rather have as much power in his own hands and the ability to use that at his discretion rather than have to defer to the Congress, which, as you know, has argued that it alone has the constitutional right to declare war and deploy American forces into combat. So he's done what I think everyone has expected. I think that suggests to me, anyway, that the status quo in terms of our engagement with the Saudi-led coalition will continue as before, and we'll provide whatever support we feel is appropriate and necessary and that can advance the interests of the coalition as it tries to push back against Houthi rebels in Yemen.
The United Arab Emirates hailed as strategic President Donald Trump's veto of the resolution, and its Minister of State for Foreign Affairs, Anwar Qarqash, said President Trump's assertion of support to the Arab coalition in Yemen is a positive signal of U.S. resolve towards America's allies. What's your take on that?
Certainly, I can understand why the Emiratis and the Saudis are quite pleased with the president's action. It does suggest that he sees their interests as very much aligned with our own, that he is going to continue America's support for their campaign in Yemen without any interruption at this point that he can anticipate. I think, conversely, if the president had not vetoed the legislation, the impact would have been far more severe, and it certainly would have emboldened the Houthi rebels in Yemen to perhaps stay further and further away from negotiations, believing that international support for the coalition in Yemen was cracking, and therefore they would be able, that is to say, the Houthis would be able to press their advantage more effectively. That's not the case, and so I think that is a great sigh of relief we hear coming from our Gulf Arab allies today.
So how would you assess the latest UN efforts to end the war in Yemen?
Well, what we've seen now is several false starts since the Stockholm Agreement was signed at the end of last year. I think Martin Griffith is persisting to try to do his shuttle diplomacy among all the parties to get them to comply with the commitments they've made. He seems to think, once again, he's got them to do so. I hope that's the case. We all do collectively hope that we can move away from just the armed conflict in Yemen to a negotiation, but we're going to have to hold our breath and see. As I say, this is not the first time that the parties have seemed to agree, and I just hope that that Martin Griffiths, and with international pressure, because we're going to need pressure on all the parties, that is to say the Houthis, the coalition parties, the Yemeni government itself, they need to hear from international community that we are very determined to see this war come to an end immediately.
That was Stephen Sechet, former U.S. ambassador to Yemen, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawy. Well, U.S. President Donald Trump's daughter and White House advisor Ivanka is in the Ivory Coast as part of her four-day trip aimed at increasing economic opportunities for women in the West Africa region. Speaking at a cocoa farm today, Ivanka Trump announced a U.S. aid and private sector joint commitment of $2 million related to Ivory Coast cocoa industry. While in Ivory Coast, Trump is scheduled to make an appearance at a World Bank policy summit. Trump, who serves as advisor to her father on economic empowerment, began her trip to the region with a visit to the Ethiopian capital of Addis Ababa on Sunday, where she announced a multi-million-dollar U.S. government initiative to support women entrepreneurs. Well, this is VOA's International Edition.
Want to relax, unwind, or charge up? Then listen to Music Time in Africa this weekend. It'll do all that for you and more. I'm Heather Maxwell. I know good music. And Africa is my passion. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for 1 hour of commercial-free Pan-African music of the highest caliber. You get great music, music news, and amazing artist interviews from rising stars to superstars. This listen will take you places. So do it. Join me for Music Time in Africa, your weekend destination.
Well, a dispute between Haiti and a U.S. energy trading firm is leading to long blackouts and fuel shortages in the Caribbean nation. Port-au-Prince's fragile power grid was dealt a blow when Novum Energy Trading Corporation suspended shipments in February, saying the government owes it $40 billion, or million dollars rather, in overdue payments for fuel. Haiti long relied on fuel shipments from nearby OPEC member Venezuela, which offered cheap financing to several Caribbean nations to buy its gasoline, diesel, and other products through a special program. But the program fell apart last year due to economic turmoil in Venezuela, forcing Haiti, the poorest nation in the Western Hemisphere, to return to international markets. Well, the U.S. government today will announce additional sanctions on Venezuela, as well as Cuba and Nicaragua, in the latest move against socialist governments in the Western Hemisphere. VOA's White House Bureau Chief Steve Herman reports the administration of U.S. President Donald Trump has prioritized dislodging Nicolas Maduro as Venezuela's leader.
Ahead of a Wednesday speech by National Security Advisor John Bolton, a senior administration official is emphasizing all options remain on the table concerning Venezuela, contending the South American country is increasingly close to a flex point. As part of the effort to dislodge Maduro, U.S. officials are also tightening pressure on Cuba for its influence over Caracas. The administration will declare on Wednesday that it will allow for the first time lawsuits to be filed in the United States against all foreign companies in Cuba using properties confiscated from American citizens in the 1960s. Steve Herman, VOA News, at the White House.
Thank you, Steve. This is VOA's International Edition.
This is Science in a Minute.
Astronomers have confirmed that TESS, NASA's new planet-hunting spacecraft, has discovered its first Earth-sized exoplanet. Also confirmed was the spacecraft's discovery of its sibling, a mini-sized Neptune exoplanet. Both planets orbit HD 21749, a sun-like star located about 53 light-years away in the Reticulum constellation. The recently discovered sub-Neptune planet is described as having 23 times the mass of Earth and a radius about 2.7 times larger than our planet. Not much is known about the Earth-sized exoplanet so far, except that it orbits its sun once every 8 days. TESS, an acronym for Transiting Exoplanet Survey Satellite, is the successor to the Kepler spacecraft, which was decommissioned by NASA in 2018. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
You've been listening to VOA's International Edition. Thanks for joining us, and thanks to our director, Nadia Taha, and our engineer, Nelson Lopes. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Press Conference USA. Next up, mass protests akin to those during the Arab Spring of 2011 have rocked both Algeria and Sudan. How are they different, and do they portend an opening for greater democracy and economic justice? We'll talk with Michelle Dunn about Algeria and Sudan next on Press Conference USA, Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.